In this part of Focus 580, we will touch on a topic that we certainly have discussed before with other guests, and that's what's happening today in the Roman Catholic Church in the United States. Our guest for the program is Peter Steinfels. He has been writing about religious issues as a journalist for some time now. He was the senior religion correspondent for the New York Times between 1988 and 1997, and now continues to write for the paper. He writes the biweekly column Beliefs. He has also worked in a number of areas. He has taught. He has been a visiting professor of history at Georgetown and of American Studies at Notre Dame. He's also worked in the area of bioethics. He was the editor of Commonweal and is the author of the book The Neoconservatives. He is also a Catholic himself. He's the author of a recently published book, one of a number that has come out recently, looking at this particular issue. The title of his book is A People Adrift. The subtitle is The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And in the book, he makes the observation that indeed it is a difficult time for the church. The very first line of the introduction to the book is, today the Roman Catholic Church in the United States is on the verge of either an irreversible decline or a thoroughgoing transformation. He says that indeed things could go either way, as a result, in either case, really as a result of a couple of big changes, transitions that are going on in the church. One of those being the transition from an older leadership to a younger leadership. The other, a transition in the leadership from ordained people, priests and nuns, to people increasingly now, lay people, who are doing administrative work, and sometimes not just administrative work, sometimes indeed religious work, the kinds of things that in the past had been done by priests and nuns. We'll try and talk about some of these issues this morning, and questions, of course, are welcome. Questions always welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Steinfels, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
I'm glad to be with you.
I certainly appreciate it. Maybe to start out, we can talk about you in the book talk, coin it for, I don't know if you coined this phrase, but I like the phrase, the leading Catholic indicators. I know those things that are an indication, some kind of indication of the health of the church. Things like, for example, how often people attend and so forth. Let's take those things and just give us a snapshot, your snapshot of where the Roman Catholic Church in America is right at the moment.
Right. I think that if one ran down the list of what I call leading Catholic indicators, you'd find a lot of things that would be, I think a business firm would take them as cause for great concern. And they involve such things as the decline in weekly attendance at Mass, the decline in the number of priests, both absolutely but also especially the ratio of priests to people in the church. They would probably include the drop in the percentage of Catholics of school age who are now in Catholic parochial schools. There would be a lot of things that would be cause for worry. Now, I also make the point that a lot of those statistics are not so clear or so easy to interpret. For example, it's clear that fewer Catholics are attending Mass weekly than in the 1960s, say, but many of them are participating more. Many of them are receiving Holy Communion, for example, which has often been a measure of devotion at much higher rates. There's a lot of other statistics that suggest it's a more complex pattern than people sometimes think, but I think it's at least enough. There's enough bad news there to be worrisome and to have some alarm bells start going off.
You know, certainly it's appropriate and understandable that, our focus here in this country should be on the church in this country. And for all I know, there are people out there writing books with subtitles like The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in Italy or The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in France or in Canada. But there seems to be something particularly American that's going on here, both in terms of the way American Catholics have reacted to, particularly to the church's leadership and its increasing conservativeness that somehow sets Catholics in this country apart from Catholics elsewhere. Now, I may be completely wrong about that, but it seems to be the case. And you can tell me whether I'm right or not.
Well, the first thing you said is interesting, that there are people writing books about the Catholic Church in France or Spain or elsewhere. I'm sure there probably are, but I suspect that that's something that is a much livelier topic in the United States, and not just now. And it's a lively topic for reasons that are a little different than what I was just saying about the worrisome signs in recent church history. The reality is the church here has about at least 67 million Americans who call themselves in one way or another members of this Catholic family, even though, like many family members, they're not always on very good speaking terms. But and that figure maybe is over 70 million, and it's roughly a quarter of the population. And compared to a lot of other countries, including many countries of where Catholicism has long been implanted and the majority religion, the church here still remains very vital. And probably because of that, you know, it's more of an issue. If there's a way in which the church in France, for example, or in the Netherlands has declined in its vitality to the extent that, you know, there aren't people up in arms about which way it's going to go and what should be the policies that it pursues. So that's my comment on the first part of your question. I mean, why do we have so much attention here? It isn't just because of the differences between America and say, the Vatican in terms of conflict. It's also because of the remaining vitality of the American church. Just to give you before one little note on that, there are over 600 hospitals with the Catholic affiliation that treat 80 million patients a year. That's Catholic and non-Catholic alike. There's a network of Catholic schools and social services and so on that is kind of unique in the world. So that's one of the reasons why there is this attention. Now, it's an old story about the conflict between a kind of American democratic activist, perhaps more individualist, a way of looking at religion and the European, in particular, Vatican way. And I think that's definitely an issue today. I think it's been an issue for a long time. I think the American experience, particularly of separation in church and state, was actually a great gift to the Catholic Church, because we know at the sort of landmark Second Vatican Council, bishops from all over the world endorsed the Declaration on Religious Liberty, which really made official Catholic policy a kind of experience that the American church had taught the rest of the church that it had flourished under this kind of separation of church and state. Nevertheless, there are American ways of looking at things that we absorb as Catholics from our Protestant and individualist culture, which puts the church often at some in some tension with particularly the Vatican.
One of the things that interests me, and as someone who is not Catholic, but certainly as someone who has known a lot of people who are, is the issue of Catholic identity And, you know, I've said this before on the program that sometimes in conversation with people who are Catholic, I've had with people who are Catholic who are disenchanted with the church, and I've said something like, well, why don't you just find yourself another church? Go to another, you know, go to another denomination. And they look at you as if you're suggesting they become a Buddhist. You know, the idea, there is something to the idea that once a Catholic, always a Catholic. And I wonder if there is some sense in which Catholic identity in this country may indeed be stronger than other places that we really think of as strongly Catholic societies.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that, that the fact of being a minority religion, even if such a sizable minority religion, I mean, actually, it's, you know, it's the Catholic Church is the single largest religious group in the country, but Catholicism, compared to other forms of Christianity, still certainly remains a minority. And that experience, which was minority in the sense of really stronger conflicts during a lot of the 19th and early 20th century, when a lot of Americans had a sort of nativist fear of Catholicism and Catholic immigrants, that helped to shape, I think, a strong identity. Now, that kind of tension between Catholic Americans and other Americans has largely disappeared. And that's, of course, then that poses problems. If you've had an identity which has got a lot of its strength from being at odds with your surrounding environment, and suddenly your surrounding environment becomes much more accepting, then does the identity get weakened? I think the American Jewish community has felt that and has discussed that. If, you know, a lot of identity was based on widespread anti-Semitism, and if that disappears, is there going to be an assimilation in which identity is largely lost? But there may be some other things, too. I think the nature of sacramental life, the emphasis on ritual and so on, may instill a kind of Catholic identity that sticks with people even when they're very much at odds with certain church teachings, or they're very discontented about the institution's organization and conduct.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have a caller here we'll get right to. We're talking this morning with Peter Steinfels. He's a journalist. He was the senior religion correspondent for the New York Times for a number of years, between 88 and 97, and now continues to write for the paper. He writes Beliefs, a biweekly column, and is author of a recent book titled A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm not Catholic, so I'm going to ask this as try to be a naive questioner. How do Catholics, you had mentioned that they were getting more conservative, how do they reconcile being quote-unquote religiously conservative with the fact that for decades they've been covering up homosexual priests for doing unspeakable acts to children, let alone other adult homosexuals? How do they reconcile that? It seems like covering up for homosexual acts is more progressive versus conservative. And the continued cover-up in the face of overwhelming evidence suggests that there's, I don't know, something weird going on. Maybe you can shed some light on that. I'll listen. Thanks.
All right.
First of all, David, I think your remark about the church being more conservative was really correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you were really commenting on how some of the church leadership, particularly under this papacy, seems more traditional in reasserting traditional positions. Am I right about that?
Yes, that was what I, yes,
right.
Maybe I wasn't
right.
Clear. I was thinking, I was thinking truly about the church leadership, right, and what has happened under this, under the current pope.
Well, first is a comment on these two terms of conservative and liberal, or conservative and progressive. They're kind of blunt terms for dealing with a lot of complicated subjects, and they're taken from political life, and I do think they have some application to religious life, but sometimes they don't serve us well. But in general, I'd say the American Catholic Church, and here I'm talking about the population and the priests and the hierarchy altogether, exhibit a strong element of conservatism in their attitude toward cultural moral issues. Sometimes we call them the social issues, family issues, sexual morality. They're more community than individualist oriented, but they're still pretty individualist, but just relative to other Americans. But they're pretty liberal in our ordinary jargon way of talking about this when it comes to, say, government intervention on behalf of the people who are the losers in the society. And the church will be anti-abortion, which is considered conservative in our society, but certainly the hierarchy is anti-capital punishment and more wary of use of military power overseas than what we seem to be where the average American position. So it's a funny mixture. I just want to put that down before. And now, when we get to the question of the recent sexual scandals, I've written a lot about that, and I've written a lot about it in the book, but I should say that I actually started this book well before the revelations that particularly marked the year 2002, although there was an earlier wave of revelations from 1985 to 1993 that made a lot of primetime news and headlines, and I covered those as a reporter, and I was going to write about them. Now, I just think that people really do have to inform themselves in some of the details, and I get a little nervous when I hear a phrase like covering up homosexual priests, as though this whole thing were not a lot more complicated than that. And when I say complicated, I don't want to somehow diminish or brush aside the fact that there was some appalling behavior, certainly on the part of the predatory priests, who still we constitute a very small percentage of the American priesthood, but there was also some appalling behavior on the part of some of their superiors who did not take the action that they should have. I have to say that you look at that and you look at, you know, different time periods, 1960s, 1980s, 1990s, you see considerable improvement, never up to what it should be. And I get a little nervous, however, if we lump it all together and then we give it a title like that was progressive or that was conservative. The things that were wrong were wrong. The things where people made bad judgments in good conscience because they were badly informed by treatment centers or the psychological literature or a lot of other things are tragic. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to avoid the tough thing about that question, but I'm nervous about it being so sweeping and using a term like progressive in regard to a cover-up.
Well, clearly, very large numbers of Catholics in this country were outraged by the way that the leadership of the church responded to this particular issue. But it seems to be the latest and perhaps the most intense example of people being unhappy with the church leadership. But that has been going on for some time, and there have been particularly a number of issues in which particularly, it seems, American Catholics have departed from the guidance and teaching of their leadership. Maybe one of the clearest examples is birth control, where it seems that very large numbers of American Catholics have chosen to disregard the church's position on birth control. Also, very big departures in the attitudes of the congregants on issues like ordination of women and women's participation fully in church life, and what the leadership, particularly in, we're talking about the very top leadership, the Vatican and Rome, feel. So the place where it's taken some time to get where we at now, and that this didn't just start with the recent revelations about sexual abuse in the church.
Absolutely. I think that the reverberations of the revelations and even the reluctance of many Catholics to say anything in defense of those complexities where they may have been a little bit more defensible. I don't think every court agreement that resulted in confidentiality and so on was done at the request of the church officials. Some of them were done at the request of lawyers for the victims or the victims themselves, and so we use a word like cover-up in very sweeping terms. But the fact is, many Catholics, you're right, they were outraged and they were unwilling to come to the defense of, because they had an underlying distrust, I think, that had been built up over the years over the kind of issues that you just mentioned. And I would say what I try and write about in A People Adrift is not only those two internal transitions in leadership from an older generation to a new generation that came of age in a very different culture and a very different church and a change from a leadership by priests and nuns to leadership by lay people. But I also talk about two external changes in the world that the church has to grapple with, and one of them has to do with sexuality. I think that the change of the our ability to separate sexual intercourse from procreation and reproduction is a kind of epical change in human history, and it has all sorts of consequences for the way we understand human sexuality. And the church, starting with the debate over birth control in the 1960s, when the church reasserted in what I think was a tragic decision the traditional opposition, despite the finding of a papally appointed commission of high church leaders and theologians, that the traditional position should be modified. That's one thing that's a really a problematic area still. And the other one's the one you very properly pointed to. We have a massive global change in our recognition of the equality and dignity of women, and therefore of their proper roles in public life. And the church, you know, it's not just a conflict between the church and the surrounding culture. It's a conflict within the church itself. This pope, on matters of sexuality, for example, when it comes to the bottom line, he is completely traditionalist. But if you listen to the language in which he has talked about sexuality, about the human body, about marital love, it's a totally different language. It's very positive, expressing intimacy, talking about the personal dimension in a way that no previous pope has ever done. And I see that as evidence that, you know, we really do have this massive shift in which the church is so far caught betwixt and between. Again, this pope has been firmer on the equality of men and women. And at the same time, we do have the reassertion that ordination to the priesthood is reserved to men, and at the same time we have the practical fact that ordination of the priesthood is kind of the gateway to much of the decision-making power within the Catholic Church. So I do think these are internal conflicts, and these are the major elements, and unlike the sexual scandals, which the Church, I think we hope and pray, will deal with, these are lasting issues. They're not going to go away. They're sort of irreversible changes. That's why I started writing this book, including the sentence that you cited at the beginning about the sort of stark alternatives between irreversible decline and thoroughgoing transformation. I wrote that sentence in 1997 because I saw these major changes which are there, and they're not going to be reversed, and the church has to come up with creative and new answers to them.
We have another caller here to talk with. Let's do that. Moultrie County, line number 4, toll-free line.
Hi.
Hello. Yes?
I'm not a Roman Catholic either, but I kind of follow what's going on. And I agree with you that these terms like progressive, conservative, liberal, and so forth are not very good. The best one that I can come up with is orthodox. And I have read that Orthodox dioceses, and two that I've seen named are Peoria, Illinois, and Lincoln, Nebraska, and some Orthodox seminaries, and I don't know where any of them are not seeing this decline in vocations, that they have a considerably larger number of applicants for the priesthood. Is can you confirm that or deny it, or what's the story there?
Well, first of all, on the very the concrete point that you raise, it's my impression that there are a number of dioceses, a few more than you mentioned, that are seen as very traditionalist and that have had good numbers of people entering the seminaries there. The reasons may not be the same in all those dioceses. This is one thing I point out in the book. By the way, it's also true of certain more traditionalist religious orders, too.
Right.
They've also had good numbers in some of their seminaries. I think this is an area where we need much more research and careful research, because in some instances, and I think Lincoln, Nebraska, people have looked at that, it may largely have to do with local factors, including some charismatic priests that have recruited successfully to the priesthood. In other areas, it may have to do with the fact that those dioceses have become target seminaries where people of a more traditionalist or conservative outlook from all around the country, sometimes people who have not made it through other seminaries, are going there and to those seminaries. And to the extent that they reflect that pattern, then it doesn't seem to be a realistic answer for the future. So that's something that I think is worth exploring. I'm going to get back to that in a minute about what it says about those seminaries and this model of the priesthood. I'm a little troubled by the use of the term Orthodox in the sense that some Catholics appropriate that to themselves. And say, we're Orthodox, which is a very important term in Christian history, and by implication, all the rest of Catholics, and that would probably include me, are somehow heretical or in apostasy or something else. And I don't think that's the case. I think that what's going on here is a serious discussion. Sometimes it's a debate, and sometimes, unfortunately, it's something approaching lethal warfare among Catholics about what is the proper understanding and the proper demands of orthodoxy for our time. I mean, I very much consider myself an Orthodox Catholic, and yet, as I just suggested, I would think that the choice of Pope Paul VI in 1968 to reject the findings of his own commission was a tragic one. Now, there's a really basic thing behind this question that's fascinating. In the introduction, David, you said something about lay people carrying out not only administrative tasks, but pastoral tasks. Mm-hmm. Today, there are 30,000 lay parish ministers, and there are 35,000 more in training who are doing all sorts of pastoral things and parish life, most of which used to be done by priests or, in some cases, sisters. And that 30,000 is a greater number than the active parish priests in all the parishes in the country. So the typical face now of a Catholic parish is more apt to be the woman who's the director of religious education than it is going to be the man who is the pastor, if it has a resident pastor. So one of the questions is, can we reverse this decline in the ratio of priests to people, which was about one priest for every 650 Catholics in 1950, and it's now one priest for probably going on almost 1,400 Catholics, because the population of Catholics has been growing today. Can that be reversed? And can it be reversed, as many more conservatives think, by drawing a sharp line between the priests and the laity? And their argument is, and it's an argument that should be attended to, that you'll only get priests if you have a very clear-cut definition of their role and, in a sense, their prerogatives and their authority in the community. Well, that may work, but how is that going to relate to the roles of this 30,000 parish ministers and 35,000 more in waiting, who are now doing all sorts of the bread and butter work of the church? Are they going to see themselves and other Catholics see them as second class, as, you know, what we get because Father isn't available, and what does that mean in terms of the quality of those people and who will be recruited and so on? That's the kind of basic choice, it seems to me, that church leaders in the next 10 years or so have got to face. Is the route a sharp line drawn between priests and laity, or do we have to think of this in pretty much entirely new terms? As a new category of lay leadership in the church, which cannot be just second-class citizens.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So, well, we've been talking about the situation here that the church in America faces, where we have the increasingly restive congregants who believe that there's a need for change, in a number of areas, the top leadership of the church in the Vatican, who seems completely, almost completely resistant to change in those very areas. And then there's another level here that we really haven't talked about, and that is the middle management of the church,
right,
particularly American bishops, who are increasingly unhappy about being buffeted about back and forth between the two groups, between their parishioners and Rome. How is all this? Obviously, you feel that the church is at a very important point here, where it could go one way or it could go the other. How do you think that it's likely that this is all going to get worked out?
Well, obviously, one thing that people say when faced with that very realistically framed question is, you know, it'll work out depending on what the next papal election, and whether that marks a greater, not necessarily some radical switch in terms of Catholic teaching on fundamental issues, the ones we find in the Creed and Scriptures, as well as important issues about sexual morality, but just more leeway in giving local churches around the world, that is, hierarchies in different regions, giving them more leeway to tailor things to their own cultures. And there's a lot of feeling that the next pope will favor less centralization of decision-making in Rome, because even a lot of conservative bishops and cardinals from around the world who will be electing the pope seem to feel that things maybe have become too centralized. So that's one thing that people point to. But I think another question exists at the level of the American hierarchy, and the bishops now, it's not a job I would want to hold. It's about the most unrewarding job in the world, but partly that's because they've created some of their own problems, obviously in regard to the sex abuse issues they have. They've become more conservative and more cautious and less willing to take initiatives and less willing to speak out about things because of the appointments in the latter half, especially of this papacy. And that's a real drawback now. I would say that if I could convince the bishops of one thing, I'd like to convince them that, well, this is more than one, I guess, but A, business as usual isn't going to do it. B, you've got to really listen to the rest of the church. And C, you've got to find a way to voice the real disagreements that exist among you about strategies to take and choices to make. You've got to find a way to voice that publicly and politely. So, because right now, too much discussion on questions like the future of the priesthood or the church's positions on a number of sexual issues, the discussion is suppressed. It may go on, but it goes on behind closed doors. And I do think the bishops within the framework, even now, of Vatican oversight, could take a lot more initiative. They could speak up more. They could look more to their own priests and parishes, and less looking over their shoulder to the Vatican in anticipation of what its reactions to various things might be.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Peter Steinfels. He was the senior religion correspondent for the New York Times from 1988 until 1997, and today writes Beliefs, a biweekly column for that paper. He is the author of the book A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America, published by Simon & Schuster. We do have some other callers here to bring into the conversation. We'll go next to someone on a cell phone on our line four. Hello.
Yes. I was just curious about annulments and how they're granted or not granted, like in the case of infidelity of one partner, and the other partner, you know, now can't actually receive the sacraments of the church. Could you go into that? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, I can't. I couldn't very quickly go into the details of how all this is carried out in practice. I think that it's based on the idea that a lot of Catholics have entered into marriage with maybe a cultural understanding of marriage, but not a genuine sacramental understanding of what that means as a permanent commitment. And therefore, in the eyes of the Church, though obviously not in the eyes of the law, their marriages were not Catholic marriages, and they can be annulled in effect. It's a recognition. It isn't annulment, really. It's a recognition that this was not a truly sacramental marriage in the first place. Now, the procedures for doing this are quite rightly a matter of controversy as to whether they're, some people would argue that they've been spiritually meaning, and they've resulted in people reviewing and much better understanding their own spiritual life. Other people have argued that the procedures are demeaning, and there's a lot of problems to it. And I won't try and go into more detail except to add finally that I think that the unresolved questions about annulments is part of the underlying distrust that many Catholics have felt that led to the outburst of anger about the sexual abuse issues. I remember talking to a man who'd been in a parish where not one but two priests had been removed because of allegations of sexual misconduct. And despite that very dramatic thing, within 2 or 3 minutes he was talking to me about his skepticism about his brother-in-law's annulment or something like that. So these things are connected in the eyes of many Catholics as well as other Americans.
Mm. I do think that it is one of those cases where if people are looking for some indication of inconsistency, that's one of the things it gets pointed to. People say, well, the Catholic Church says there's no such thing as divorce except when we decide that there's divorce. And people can point to cases where somebody was granted an annulment who actually was married and had children, and that somehow doesn't truly make sense.
Well, there are some profound theological issues here that have to also be attended to, and there's been a tradition in Western Christianity and Catholicism of seeing marriage as really a contract, which is kind of totally, it's like an on and off switch at the very time of the marriage itself. And so then you do get these cases where people apparently had a flourishing marriage for many years, and then it broke down somehow in a way that the couple separated, and one or the other of them wanted to remarry. And then, rather than looking at the post-marriage process in its full complexity and so on, there's this kind of legal examination that goes back to what people understood about marriage and how capable they were of making a fully knowledgeable and intentional decision at the time they were married. And I think in the eyes of many people, that does not jibe with their understanding of the ongoing process of marriage.
Let's talk with someone else. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the writer Paul Williams? I was browsing at the Urbana Library the other day and found a new book that was
written by him called The Vatican Exposed, about the ties with the Vatican and the Roman Church in general, and the ties to the Holocaust, the ties to the Vatican Bank with drug laundering money, and ties to the Mafia, and the importation of money from the Mafia to the Vatican Bank. There's no accounting of that money at all.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that name or that book, therefore I can't comment directly on it. I guess I have to give, as many of my views are, a little bit of on the one hand, on the other hand, statement. On the one hand, I don't think the Vatican is above close investigation, and I don't believe that as a bureaucracy and so on, it hasn't had its Enron moments. I also know that there's a long tradition in American culture of anti-Catholic literature that in which all these kinds of things can be lumped together. For example, I'm surprised that a subject about the Church's relationship to the Holocaust is something to which I've given a fair amount of attention, and I think I'm fairly familiar with most of the serious writing on this subject, and this is not something that, this is not a name that comes to mind. So I'm a little wary about, you know, the line between proper investigation and critique and things that are the anti-Catholic parallel of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and other classic anti-Semitic literature. We have a fair amount of that in our culture.
The book did seem to be very well documented, and I would recommend that anyone that's interested in the topic check it out. It's called The Vatican Exposed by Paul Williams.
All Could right. you tell me what the, who the publisher is?
The publisher, I can't tell you right off.
Publisher is Prometheus.
Prometheus, yes, that's right. Thank you.
Okay, Prometheus is a press which is connected with to the a movement that, that calls itself and isn't just called by others a kind of a secular humanist movement, and so I'd want to look very carefully at the documentation. I know how to do footnotes, and at the ideological orientation of the whole book.
Well, I appreciate the suggestion of the caller. We're down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. I want to return to just one issue, just for of the many, for a moment here, just because I think for you, the issue of gender equity, how we think about men and women and women's participation in the church is very important. And I guess the thing that I'm interested in hearing just a little bit more about, unfortunately, we have 2-3 minutes, is the issue of ordination of women, something that the Vatican has just said this is not open for discussion. That's that. We've closed the question. It's not going to happen. But apparently, many American Catholics feel that would be a good thing. And of course, we're dealing with the issue of declining numbers of men interested in becoming priests. Do you in fact think that that's something that within our lifetimes that we're likely to see?
I personally think we are, myself, but I devote a lot of discussion in A People Adrift to the serious theological arguments about ordaining women to the priesthood, and I have to say that personally I find the arguments against it not persuasive. On the other hand, I think that Catholics think as a church. They act they need to think and develop their theology communally. And so in the book, I advocate the immediate movement toward the ordination of women to the diaconate, which is considered by Catholics kind of a part of the holy orders, but it isn't the priesthood per se. And I think that historically, since precedent counts a lot in Catholic tradition, there's a lot of precedent for that in the early centuries of the Church. And then I think that the Church should actually encourage serious, I don't mean bumper sticker, but I mean serious theological discussion of the ordination of women to the priesthood and not penalize that discussion. So I'm kind of for a gradualist incrementalist approach on this, but personally, I don't find the arguments that are currently being offered against the ordination of women to be persuasive.
Well, as a way of finishing at the very beginning, I mentioned the fact that you begin the introduction to your book by saying that a statement that today the Church, Roman Catholic Church in the United States, is on the verge of either irreversible decline or thoroughgoing transformation. So obviously you're saying, well, things could go one way or the other.
Right.
Do you have a particular feeling about, indeed, what is the more likely path?
You know, every other day I see another sign either of hope or discouragement, and I swing back and forth praying for the hopeful developments and trying to understand as best I can the ones that seem so discouraging. So for my mind, this is not a settled matter. I did put a little piece of art on the cover of the book, which is a 16th century stained glass window that's in the Metropolitan Museum here in New York, of Jesus calming the storm on the Sea of Galilee, something recounted in the Gospels, and I suppose that's some expression ultimately of hope rather than discouragement.
All right. Well, there we're going to have to leave it. Again, the book is A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America, published by Simon & Schuster, by our guest Peter Steinfels, former senior religion correspondent for the New York Times, and continues to write for the paper, writes a biweekly column, Beliefs. And Mr. Steinfels, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, and thank all your callers.